Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting from Atlanta, Georgia, this is The Bright Side with Technisha.
A daily broadcast on real-life issues that will keep you motivated.
And now, here's your host, Technisha.
Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of The Bright Side with Technisha. Of course, I'm your host, Technisha, and I'm here with Mr. Lewis Ellman, who is the co-founder of Advanced Corporation and author of the Low Cost Empire series. Good afternoon, Mr. Ellman. How are you?
Okay. Good afternoon, Ms. Day. Glad to be here.
I'm so glad for us having you on this show today, because I'm ready to get started on about talking about trademarks and patents, because that's exactly what I want to do to build my career up. So, Mr. Ellman, give us a little detail about your background and what it is that you do.
Okay. Well, since 1983, I've been teaching. I started out teaching legal. I was in the legal field for 22 years in the top-tier legal field, teaching legal computers. And around the same time, I also got interested in invention-type concepts, and I was interested in doing entrepreneurial things. But as you know, when you're young and you have some good ideas, the first thing that you say to yourself is, wow, I got a great idea, but I have no clue what to do with it. And then a lot of people lead you around, and you get a run around, and then you start to feel, oh, my God, this is so much money, and, oh, I guess these things, it's a lot more, you know, to do for these things to come true than I thought, and you start to back off, and then you start to realize after you start looking into it that it is all doable, and you don't have to defer to other people exclusively to get things done. As you start to know the process yourself, it becomes more doable by the day, and you know you're able to take care of a lot of this by yourself before you have to go for legal advice, before you have to spend large blocks of money that you may or may not have. And it's something where if you're just willing to put the time in yourself and just do a little bit of investigation and you're able to take it on piece by piece, you can learn this as good as anybody else in the industry who does this for a living. And I think I'm a prime example of that, because that's what I've done since I'm about 30 years old. I'm 54, and for 25 years almost, I've been doing my own things in terms of any idea that I come up with. I'm able to go through a certain routine and get it into shape, or helping other people get their ideas into shape so that they can then move forward without feeling that they're up against the wall and other people have to do it all.
Because I'm glad that, like I said, I'm glad that you're on the show, because I want to create a, I guess it's a trademark, well, it's a phrase, and I ended up calling LegalZoom, and they told me it's going to be $514 just to have my own catchphrase, because it's yours permanently. Would that be such a great idea to go through a company like that?
This is the deal. I just finished a book about a month ago called Low Cost Empire, Getting Ready for Business, Getting Down to Business, Filing Your First Trademark.
Yes.
In that book, and I'm going to answer your question in full, by the way, so I didn't forget your question. In that book, I walk you through a trademark from beginning to end. I handhold you. I introduce you to the entire concept. I show you how to search out the mark yourself to see if it's viable. I teach you how to do the application and draft your description step by step. I then take you through what they call office actions, six possible office actions that you can receive from the trademark office. By the time you're through, you will be able to talk the talk and walk the walk. You can probably file that trademark yourself.
Oh,
now,
God.
As to a LegalZoom, what you're going to get, because it's an automated system, is a very generic type filing. The problem with LegalZoom is what they're not telling you with a patent or a trademark is that after you file the patent or trademark, you will then have most often, not all time, but I'd say 90% of the time, you will receive from the trademark office what's called an office action. It's nothing to get worried about. It's simply saying that a piece of your application needs some tweaking or needs some correction. But they don't tell you about that. And in order to do that, you really have to be, if to do it yourself, you have to be comfortable enough and understand that it's not a big deal and what the process is, which I show you in that book. What they're going to do is they're going to then recommend an attorney who can do your office action for you, which might be something you could take care of yourself in 20 minutes, but that's going to cost you. So you just have to know that if you go the route of LegalZoom, yes, they will spoon feed you through an application process. You'll get a generic type application, but there will be office actions, and you have to be ready that you will need to pay somebody to do those for you if you're not willing to delve into it and just understand what's really going on yourself. It's not rocket science. I think a lot of people feel that, and it's been made that because it's an industry, and the people who do that for a living want to make sure that you feel it's really out of your league. It's not. Okay. Anyone can do this stuff.
Okay, so I could do it on my own, but how do I go about doing it, Elman?
Well, if the way you go about doing it is you don't jump into it. You make sure you first learn the process. It's not difficult. The process is the process. It never changes. What you do is you keep your name under wraps. You don't want to be telling people all over the place what your name is so that they can literally take it from you. So you want to keep things in a stealth mode while you learn about the trademark process. And then once you're ready to go, you file it. Now, you said you were talking about your trademark in terms of a, which was very interesting. You were talking about it as a tagline more than a mark. So sometimes people will have a name and they want to trademark that name, and then along with the name they have a tagline. So for instance, I had a company years ago called, I had a trademark iDesign. The tagline for iDesign was where the I means you. So sometimes people just have a trademark by itself, and then others will have a trademark and then a tagline underneath. Years ago, Nike was Nike, just do it. Right? Things like that. So it depends. It does not have to be a tagline. You can have just a straightforward trademark without the tagline or both. It doesn't matter. Each trademark is individual, and it always fits the bill for whatever you're doing, you know.
Now, I was quite confused on the difference between trademark and patent.
Well, when you're dealing with a trademark, you're dealing with a brand. You're trying to establish your identity as a brand. You're trying to grow a brand name. When you go to the store, some people love a specific brand. Other people don't care, and they buy the store brand. But they say, nope, I have to have Ivory. I have to have, whatever it is that you love, the specific product. You won't dare buy the store brand. So you build, it's brand building, using a trademark to build your brand, to establish an identity where people recognize your brand based on the experience that they've had with that brand when they've bought your brand before. You start to develop what's called brand loyalty, and then as you come out with new things under that same brand, well, they already know you about that other thing you're selling, and they're comfortable and they like your products. They're more likely to buy your next item that comes out under that brand. A patent, the difference is a patent is a utility patent, which is most of the patents. Those are devices. They're usually a device of some sort. In some cases, a patent is a business model, but most of the time you're dealing with a device opposed to a name or an identity.
Okay.
So a device could be, right, I came up with a great part for a car that because of this part, now the car will get 10 times more gas mileage, and I came up with a new this or a new that, That's the difference. It's a utility. It's a physical object usually that they've come up with.
Okay. Because I know my brand, I was going to go with my name, Technisha, because I found it very unique. I know there are not... thank you. I know there are not people out here who have that name, and every time somebody hears it, oh, your name is so unique. So that's why I just started the show with the Bright Side with Technisha. And when you look for me, I can say I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook. That is my name. I'm branding myself.
That's right. And what you'd be able to do is what I have everybody do when I work with them or when they read my books, they notice that right away, is the first thing I have people do when they have a concept for a trademark name is a three-step essential process, because you don't want, in your case, I think you're good to go. I don't think there's anybody in the world, I don't think you have any problem with stepping on any toes with your name. But this is the normal routine. The normal routine would be to go into the trademark database under USPTO.gov. You go to trademarks. You go to new user search. You put in the proposed name. And you see if there's any hits. If there's no hits, which is likely, if there's no hits, then you want to start searching out the name. You want to start searching out pieces of the name. So in your case, I would search your name. I would search anything that's close. You want to try to get a feel what's out there, because if there's something out there that's a bit too close to you, not in your case, I don't think you're going to have any problem, but a bit too close to you, you're going to file a trademark for $325. You don't want to throw that down, you know, you don't want to throw that away. If the filing is a bit too close to an already existing filing or an already trademark name, they can then reject the application, and then you'll simply lose the $325. So you really want to take the time, take a couple of days to in the database to really make sure that there's nothing close. Now, by close, I mean classification. Trademarks use an international classification listing.
Okay.
And that listing, so if Lewis sells something, Lewis Computers, okay? And
okay.
Then there's somebody, Lewis Plants and Things, I don't have to worry about the person selling horticulture compared to somebody doing computers. It's too far away, so there's not going to be a problem. But if there's a Lewis Computers and the Lewis cell phones, well, the average consumer might say, oh, that could be the same company.
Okay.
So if there's any danger of the consumer thinking that the two separate entities could be one, then they will reject you. They'll reject your filing.
Okay,
so
I was going to say, just like your name, when you pull your name up on the internet, you'll see the same similar name, but it be with a different, they're doing something different on the internet.
That's right. And you have to, that's right. And your goal is to make sure that that difference that they do is far enough apart from what you're doing to not be in conflict if they've already, if they're already filed and they've been, awarded a trademark or they're somewhere in the application process. Those people who have already beat you into the trademark database, you want to make sure they're not close enough. If they are, and if you find out that somebody already has your proposed name, go back to the drawing board, because most of the time you're going to come up with something that's way better than even the first one that you thought was great. So you don't, you know, you don't say, oh, woe is me, and just go back to the drawing board, give it a few days, think about it, let something else come to mind, and then check again. Now, let's say in your case, go ahead. No, I'll answer your question.
Go ahead.
What I was going to say is, if you're okay in the database, and you really searched it out, and you've searched out all these different combinations and everything that could be, and look at everything that's in there, and, you know, in the database they have this exact phrase and then any word within my proposed trademark. Look at everything, even if it takes you a few days, even if you have to go through 5,000. Who cares? You know, look at them. Look at what people are doing. The only thing you care about is live trademarks. So that will cut down what you have to look at significantly. Live trademarks versus dead trademarks. The dead trademarks are dead. They've been abandoned. So there's no worry about that. So you really only have to look at the live. If you're good and you're comfortable and there's nobody out there with your proposed name, move on to the next thing. make sure the domain name is available.
Okay.
You're hoping that the domain name, the .com, is available. If it's not, see how many items are actually available. So if you go to GoDaddy.com or one of them, you'll see that if it says the .com has been taken, you'll then see what's still available. I would grab as many of them as I could if I was that comfortable with the name and I really wanted that name, because you can always keep track of the .com, who owns it, and you can always see when it's due. Under the right next to any domain you look up, there will be a who is section. And that who is section will allow you to see who owns it and when it's due, when it is due to expire. And if you keep track of it, you know, you might be able to re-grab it. You might be able to grab it when it expires if that individual does not re-up and take it for another year.
Okay.
But what I usually do is I'll grab a .com, I'll grab the .us, because any U.S. person is, you know, the U.S. extension is for any trademark holder in the United States. So by law, you're entitled to that, the .us. So you can grab the .us, the .com, whatever else strikes you as something you want to also have. And if you grab...
I was going to say, you tell me the finding about who used .us.
The .us is good to have because it's the United States extension for the domain names, and people who are trademarked are entitled to that .us.
Okay.
And, other people like to grab the .net. Some people grab .info, .org. It all depends what you're doing. I try to grab as many as I could without going crazy, and I don't want other people jumping on the bandwagon. If you have a really good name and using like a main domain name, you know, you don't want to leave them like floating out there. If you could, you don't want to leave them hanging in the wind for other people to grab, if you could help it. You know, the other thing I would do is, once you've checked out the domain names and you're comfortable and you grab enough of them, then go and check out corporate availability, if you choose to use your name as your corporate name as well.
Okay.
So you can go to your state, you look up the official state website, and under the official state website, you go to corporate, and then there's always a search area to let you search out the names, your proposed name, to see if it's available as a corporation. If it's not available in your state, you can always incorporate in another state using your proposed name.
Okay.
And that's perfectly fine. The only thing you have to do is, when you are incorporated in another state, you have to get what's called a registered agent. It's very inexpensive, usually less than $100 a year. And the registered agents provide for you an address, an official address that you can use for your out-of-state corporation.
Okay.
So that people, so if anybody had a problem or anybody needs to contact you, they have an official address in this other state where they can send papers to you, legal papers to you, information to you, and then those people, from time to time, they either do it once a month or twice a month, they will package up anything that comes for you and send it to your home address.
Okay, so I could be right where I'm at right now, and they could still send it to me.
Absolutely. Wherever you are, and then for whatever reason you decided to do a Nevada corporation or, you know, a Delaware corporation, they would just package up any mail that comes to you to this address that they provide as a registered agent for that state, and they will mail it to you.
Okay, that's not bad. That's awesome.
But just keep in mind, some people will have a trademark that identifies who they are and their brand, but their corporation will be a different name. They use it as an umbrella corporation that maybe encompasses all the different things they're doing.
Okay.
So you can do that.
Well, that's not bad. That's simple enough. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you're the author of the Low Cost Empire series, which there are six books to this series. What inspired you to write those?
Oh, well, when it comes to the low-cost empire, I wanted to put immediately usable material into people's hands, and I wanted to be able to explain, because what I do best is I'm a teacher. So my gift is being able to take materials that other people might think are complex and break it down so that anybody can understand it and make full use of it. And that's what I've been able to do. The first book I called an entrepreneurial textbook because I went over so many different areas that people should be aware of to expand their awareness. The second book was devoted solely to inventors, and I gave them a very good game plan where they set their sights on a year so that they can really educate themselves and get up to speed and not just take a new idea and just run to somebody immediately. So they're going to do everything for you. They'll never have the same type of feel for the invention that you will, and they'll never be able to do to it what you could do if you were more in control. So that's what I did for that second book. The third book, which was Making an Industry Out of Your Book, I teach people how to read, you know, how to, how to create their own book. Anybody can author a book. I think everybody living has a couple of books in them. How to write your own book, how to monetize the book, make money off the book, how to create an entire business around the book, you know, how to publish to four or five major self-publishing companies, how to format the books. And I go over a laundry list of things that people can do in order to make money once the book is established, how to assess the book for intellectual property. So maybe the book would be a wonderful book to trademark the name because you plan to write a series of the books.
Okay.
Or there's characters in the books that are wonderful and they can go from book to book and you want to protect those characters, such as Harry Potter or James Bond or, you know, anybody like that. A self-help book series that may be a wonderful idea for a self-help book series, and you do set four, five, six of them. You can then maybe take that first book you did and you can protect it in terms of trademark so that, you establish a brand. Oh, yeah, he writes great books for this. I always get his, I can't wait for his next book. That type of thing. The low-cost empire number four was a bit different. That's where I go about examining about 25 different scenarios that occur within companies that people who own businesses or work in companies should be aware of, and then I go about how I would correct them. So that's a little bit of a different book. There's a lot of learning material in there, but it's more of a mirror of showing how certain companies go about business. They may not realize how it looks from the outside and how I would correct it. The fifth book, I should say the trademark book, that's the next book, that is literally a from start to finish, how to file your own trademark from beginning to end, and I literally handhold you through the entire experience, and you learn a ton. And then the one that I've just finished happens to be that's getting ready for investors, and I show you how to create a presence in a stealth manner, how to create a presence, how to get ready in order to approach people to ask for money for a venture that you're doing. I show people about the trademark, the patent, the copyright aspect. I show people how to raise money initially in a number of ways. I show them how to put together the business plan. I show them how to put together executive summaries. It's really a very inclusive book that anybody thinking of expanding and looking for money and going to people and establishing a worldwide presence, they need to look at that book, definitely. And it really will increase their awareness and really will put them in a position to have their company look like a company on paper and when people look them up, look like a company that's ready to make that next step. That leap.
Yeah, and when you definitely start a business, you want people to be able to trust you. Makes me think about the show Shark Tank. I think that's the name of it. Where they have to present them about their business, and then the people be like, no, how can I trust you if you all lost all this money? So it's about trust. So like you're saying, find out through the books. The books will help you step by step, because the more you know, the better your business will be, and you will build up that confidence with other people. But in your book, I think that was volume one, you mentioned the three-step process to start business.
Mm-hmm.
Can you share those with us?
That is that three-step process that we went over a few minutes ago. Three-step process was the reason I emphasized the three-step process of checking out the domain, the trademark for availability, checking out the domain for availability, and then checking out the corporate name for availability. The reason that's such a big deal is that people will come up with a name, and then without checking, they'll get very excited. They'll then buy letterhead paper. They'll do all of these different things. They'll get business cards with that name. They'll start the ball rolling. They'll start using it. Then all of a sudden they get a letter in the mail from some attorney representing a company, and they say, hey, cease and desist. You're using my name.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am protected. I have a United States trademark, and you're in violation. And if you don't stop it, the next letter, we're going to go to court. So if they would have just checked out first, make sure the availability is there, then they wouldn't go through that. So they're jumping the gun. They get excited about a new concept or a new name, and they jump the gun. They just start using it right away. You know, there's no protection. They didn't protect it. They didn't file a trademark, and they didn't even go out of their way to check if somebody else already owns it, because it becomes property. And people will protect that property like anything else. You know, a big company, go dare to use their name. See what they do to you. They will come after you.
I am guilty of that. I'm guilty right now that because I did my business cards and I did my pens, but I put my trademark and my phrase on there. Of course, this year I'm going to make sure I check into the phrase so I can get it taken care of so no one else will have to use it. But I jumped the gun. But, Elman, I wanted to ask, what are some of the pros and cons of starting your own business?
Well, the pros are, I think the pros for starting your own business is it keeps you moving in a forward direction. It keeps you moving in a direction of always learning, expanding your knowledge, expanding your awareness, being independent. The more independent you are and you're not in a 9-to-5 environment, the more you're using your own brain, the more you're solving problems, the more you need to be creative, the more you need to be inventive, the more you have to be aware of competition, who's out there doing something similar, how could I do it better? You know, I think it's a great thing to have your own business. I think it's a very healthy thing if everything goes right. The only downside is that if you have a problem and you're not able to overcome it, that you and you do lose a business or it does go out of business, that you let it affect you in a way where you never try again. I think that, you know, there's been many people in the past who have failed and failed and failed and failed and then all of a sudden have become extremely successful. So that if you have a business, the only downside is if something doesn't go well and you have to close your door, that you don't give up, you try again. At some point, you know, you pick yourself up and you try another business. And maybe the next one will be that much better.
Okay.
But I think it's a wonderful thing to have a business. And not to say that people who are working in a 9-to-5 situation do not work very hard. I've done both. They work extremely hard, but the mentality is different. Always aware that you're under somebody's watch. You're always aware that you could be replaced any day. You're always aware that you do not own anything, that you are a work for hire, and every day is at the behest of your employer. So it's a different mindset. When you're an owner, I think it really helps to build up your self-esteem. And when things go well, it really helps to make you feel even more empowered to do more.
Okay. I do seem to agree with all of this, because it's very important to know what you're getting into before you get burned. I would love to talk about industry watching that you talked about in your volume one.
Well, okay. Industry watching is what's the most embarrassing thing that could happen to somebody in an industry where they claim to know what's going on? That's when somebody mentions something in your industry and you have no clue what they're even talking about. So industry watching, let's say you have a patent idea. People who, let's say you've already gone to the patent search database in the USPTO and you try to get a feel whether that thing is already out there, okay? And you got a little bit of an idea, or it looks to you like, well, I see little aspects of what I have in mind, but I really don't see my thing, so maybe I've got a unique concept. But, you know, there are trade magazines out there that will give you the state of the art. So whatever industry you're in, if you go to, I think my favorite is TradePub, tradepub.com, where you can get an industry magazine from any industry you work in. Those type of magazines are going to be talking about the state of the art, what's going on in your particular area at the moment. And those are the type of things that you want to be reading all the time. Because if you're not up on every little aspect of your industry, then either if you're in a patent situation, you're going to falsely think that you have something totally unique when it certainly could already be out there. And many patent places are going to tell you, oh, it's wonderful, it's great. They're going to tell you it's great because a lot of them are out to make money on the concept or just, you know, going through the process, and they try to get you a patent. Most attorneys will tell you after an expensive search that, hey, your idea is in fact out there already. You know, it's out there. But you can do a lot of that research on your own. You can be looking. Industry trade magazines are great. Going on the internet and starting to put in keywords having to do with what you know what your industry is, and seeing what comes up. You don't know what could be out there right now. No matter what you do, the industries seem to move very fast in this, you know, today. Things are moving very fast where developments happen very quickly. So maybe a year ago something wasn't out there that you thought of, and all of a sudden you turn around, somebody else is already doing it. So those are the type of things to avoid embarrassment, that you don't know something that's in your own industry, never heard of it. And to, if you're a patent person, you owe it to yourself to know the state of the art up to the minute. So anywhere that you can get your hands on information, you want to do that.
Okay. Also, I would like to know the difference. I don't know if it's too much difference in private label and affiliation.
There's difference. Okay.
Okay.
Let's go over private label, which is a wonderful thing. No matter, let's take the hairstylist, okay, the barbershop, if you want to say that. You have a barbershop or a hairstylist. You have a very good following. You have good business. And then you say, you know what? I'd love to create some residual income with products. Since I have such a popular place and everybody knows my name in the whole neighborhood, in the whole, you know, let's say 20-mile square radius, they all come to me. I'd love to create some other residual income. So maybe they go, you know what? We could offer some hairspray, shampoo, conditioner, whatever, all right? And they say, well, if you were to do that from scratch, if you were to go to somebody or a chemist and said, hey, could you create a shampoo or this or that, that would be prohibitively expensive to have them come up with a unique new formulation for you. So what a lot of people do is they go to the internet and they start to look up private label. They put the words private label and put in private label shampoo. Private label this, private label that. Up comes a gazillion stores, or a gazillion websites, I should say, that do just that. They allow you to put your label on their product, and you have an overnight line of products to offer. And that gives you an overnight line of products to offer, and many of them nowadays will let you do a very small initial order to see if the public likes what you're offering. you can always switch it out and add something different. You don't have to, you know, years ago when you did private label, it was like 2,500 minimum. Now you can get, most of them are letting you do minimums of 10, 12, 20. So it lets you get a feel whether your potential customers like the product, and if they like it, well, you know, you got a winner, and you just keep ordering. But you will find private label under anything, sunglasses, clothing, hats, pants, shoes, sneakers, private label, whatever you can put after the words private label, you will find.
Okay.
So that gives that gives the individual a chance to have an overnight custom line of whatever business they're in.
Well, once you get started with the private label, do you advise them to also get a product liability insurance?
Well, I believe that you are protected by the company that sells you the private label. But it doesn't hurt. I don't think it could hurt you. But I believe that you are always protected by the company who does the private labeling. And by law, when you do private label, you have to show the ingredients on the back, and you have to have they already have that on their bottles, 90% of these, you know. They have that information, but you also have to show your information on your label. So you have to have something on your label, either a phone number or a website. So if you're going to put your name on it, your label has to at least have a website or a phone number so that people know that they can call you concerning your product that you sold them, especially if it's a chemical-based product like a shampoo or this, you know.
Okay. I got you.
But I think the damage is minimal, if you know what I mean. The possibilities of things going wrong are minimal.
Well, it seems like it would be minimal. Now, Lewis, let me ask. Now,
let me tell you about affiliation. Go ahead. Ask your question. I apologize.
Is that dealing with like businesses mostly, like private schools?
Are we talking about affiliation?
Yes.
Okay. When it comes to affiliation, it could be anything. But my favorite use of affiliation, I'll give you an example. Anybody with a website might want to add items to that website that may not be their core business but complement their business. So if you're a restaurant, and maybe somewhere on your restaurant webpage, on that page you want to also offer items having to do with the food industry. So you can go to an affiliate, a major affiliate broker like Commission Junction or Linkshare, and you can look for advertisers on those brokers that have things to do with the restaurant business or food, and you feel might complement your existing website. So that allows you to create a residual income besides the restaurant itself. So maybe you sell cookbooks, or you sell aprons, or you sell, you know, things having to do with cooking, the whole industry of cooking. Or maybe there's a line of pots that you recommend, you know, having to do with people who are really into cooking, you know, and anything having to do with food, or maybe condiments. Maybe there's a condiment line that are hooked up with one of the affiliate brokers, and that line would be like, oh, you know, I would love to offer these spices too on my site. This would be a great complement to what we already do as a core business. Okay, now, what you mentioned was the schools. That's my favorite use of affiliation. I think the most profitable is when you have a situation, whether it's a church or a school or a club of some sort, where there's a loyal following. Or an animal shelter, where there's a group of people who are very loyal to that organization because they all want that organization to do well. So if an organization creates on their website a shopping site where there's about 30, 40 stores of the most popular stores that most people are shopping in anyway, they're all going there anyway, whether they go to Amazon or this one or wherever they get their clothing or their electronics or downloads or whatever they're doing as a group. Everybody's going to be using the Internet anyway. You might as well make money off of it. So if you have a group like a school and they need money all year, to raise money all year long, you can, and let's say the school has 2,000 students, you can say, look, we have a website, part of our website, we have a shopping area that if you go through us to get to all your favorite stores, if you go through us, we will make commissions off of the fact that you went through us to get to Macy's. And then all throughout the year, you can be making commissions for your school. And those will add up. If you have 2,000 families all shopping, and they make sure that they go to your school site and then go to Macy's through you in order to get to Macy's, you will make a commission off of that. And then there are thousands of popular stores. So you can put as many of these stores on it. You can make a mini mall on your site and create a residual income all year long. And when you get to the holidays, you know, your entity, whatever it is, your school, your church, your organization is going to even do that much better. And if people know that if every time I go shop, it's helping the school, they're going to go shop through there.
Okay.
So and the great thing about affiliate programs is they cost you nothing. They cost nothing to implement, and they cost nothing to the people who make use of the banners that they put on their site. So they're absolutely free to implement, and then all it takes for a loyal following is to alert them that it's there, to please shop through us to get to all your favorite stores. So I think it's a very valuable thing to have. And it's a way for people to raise money if they're up to something, you know, if they're trying to, they have some sort of goal or business goal, or you know, depending, some people even will approach an organization and say, look, I'm trying to do XYZ. I would love to install a full-fledged affiliate program for your organization, and we'll do a 50-50 split. You know, sometimes it's done like that, or other times the organization already has people within it who are website type people, and they would know how to do that. They just maybe have never thought to do that. So there's a lot of different types of situations for that, but it is great.
Now, in skipping along to your volume 3. You talk about the laundry list approach to developing an informational or fiction book. Now, this is what I would love to talk about for the ones who want to maybe one day write their own book.
That's right. Well, a lot of people will say, what do you mean write a book? How am I gonna, I'm not an author. Well, I think anybody living can write a book. You have something you want to talk about. You have some experience you want to share. You're good at, you do some trade that you want to show people how you do it or you know, give your way or your way of going about things. A lot of people say, well, where do you start? How do you write a book? They're looking at it as a labor instead of let's first get clear the types of things we want to cover, and within the major topics, let's get clear all the little subtopics that can be mentioned under the major topics. So that's why I call it a laundry list, because you start a list of generalities, and then under each of those big general headings, you start to say, oh, yeah, I can also talk about this and this and this and this while talking about that major thing. And you go on to the next major item that you would cover. And you say, well, if I'm going to talk about that, oh, I might as well talk about this, and what about this little nuance, and so when you're finished and you have such a thorough list, you're not going to write a general book. It's going to end up being a very informational-packed book because you took the time to really think about not only generally what I want to cover, but within each general heading, all the little tiny things I'd like to cover within that heading. So when you're done and you actually, then what you do is you take your laundry list, you start writing, and you literally expand out on each one of your major categories and each one of your little minor categories, and sometimes you have minor categories within that same major category. You're not leaving anything out. When this whole thing is said and done, you have a very thorough book. And then when it comes to people, the people who are doing the stories, use the laundry list to try to give yourself an idea of how the storyline is going to unfold. Even if you don't know the ending yet, you can sort of say, well, they would start out living here or doing this or doing that. Then this one will meet this one, and this will come about. And you try to give yourself an idea of how your book or how the story is going to unfold, even if you don't know the ending. A lot of people don't know the ending at first, and then as they're going along, the thing is literally evolving as you're going along, and then you get to the end at some point, you know. But the laundry list is to make you see that once you've hashed out all the different things you want to cover, that you now have a book staring at you. You just have to – you can think of the laundry list as a way of interviewing yourself.
Okay.
And then you just answer very thoroughly all those things on that list until you have a nice, you know, large amount of material. Then you start shaping it up and you go over it again. You keep combing it and you smooth it out. And you make sure it reads like a book, you know, and you smooth it out as much as you have to. And then your final process is to format that book properly so you get it ready for all the different publishing companies. But it's very simple to format.
Now, once you get through formatting and everything, mm-hmm. it comes into for intellectual property, like securing the automatic protection of your book?
Well, there's a couple of things you can do. If you have a line of books, or you said, you know, this is going to be a great line of books, and the name of the book is really very good for a line of books, this is going to be a very, very catchy thing. Before you release that book, you might consider checking it out for trademark protection.
Okay.
You can also take a copy of the book, and you can do a copyright. Now, if you do an electronic copyright at copyright.gov, it'll cost you $35, and it's very simple to do, and you just got to take it step by step. You're basically putting in the author's name. You're basically putting in, was it ever published yet? If it's not, is it an unpublished work? And you're answering a few questions. You're uploading the book file, and you're basically, then you'll get, the Copyright Office will give you a number associated with that filing, and it's just to show that you had that concept and that book at a certain date. So if somebody else takes your words at some point, you can show that it was certainly yours at a certain time.
And as I always learned, you always supposed to use the copyright symbol no matter what on your own work.
That's right. And by law, even if you didn't file a copyright in the Copyright Office, by law you are allowed to put the copyright. What you're basically saying is these words are mine. These are my unique words. I did not take these from other people. You know, you're claiming it is your work. You're claiming most of the books that people do, you're claiming a textual copyright. You know, you're not, unless you're the author or you're the creator of the pictures and photos in the book as well. Are claiming what they call a textual copyright. The words are theirs, and, you know, if you take the words verbatim as I've stated them, then you're infringing on my copyright.
And then there was a site, if anyone is interested in getting that done, there's a website that you can find at www.copyright.gov where mm-hmm. you can copyright, and also you can register your work online by creating an account and log into the Electronic Copyright Office. And I think that's at eco.copyright.gov/e-service, which I'll put up on my site because it's a little long, so I will make sure I give that to you.
Mm-hmm. And you should know too that in the Copyright Office, when you file, you can file your book. The Copyright Office is good for sound recordings. The copyright is good for film. The copyright is good for pictures. So depending on what line of work you do, if you're an artist or you're an author, you will be covered. you can definitely put a copy of that item to show that you had it, you know. And then, yes, there is electronic copyright on the Copyright Office website. That's ECO. It's an electronic copyright. You can certainly do it electronically for $35, or you can do a paper version for $45.
Oh, okay.
You actually send it into the Copyright Office physically for $45, so $10 more. But you can certainly do the electronic for $35. And for people who have compilations, a bunch of unpublished materials, but they're all in a theme, you can do what's called a compilation, where you take all of these items. Maybe you wrote 20 short stories, right? And they're all basically the same theme, and you can separate them in the documents. You can take each of the short stories and separate them with like a slip of paper, or on the computer you put in a blank and you say where it delineates each story to show a new story has come in, and you can file those as a collection of works, as a collection, as an unpublished collection, and then you're still, and you can do it all under one, all under the same filing. And again, that goes to show that, hey, I had these. This was my work at a certain date. I'm filing it. If somebody gets wind of your stuff and decides to take it, at least you have something you can go to the Copyright Office with and think, you know, and to prove that was yours, that you had done that work.
But normally,
unfortunately, there's a lot of people out there who love to, they're very good at taking your stuff, but not good at creating.
Now, most copyright offices, they don't normally check that your work title is unique.
No, they're not looking for that. They're just going to protect the word. So if you did a book you went out of your way to write a book, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, and somebody doesn't just wholesale scoop up your words and then use your words in another book or a magazine or a blog and just use it and never give you credit.
Yeah.
It's fine if they use your words, but somewhere in using your words, they should say, hey, the article by Lewis Spellman here. You know, if they're not doing that and they're just simply using your words, they're not doing the right thing by you.
Reminds me of a research paper. You're just writing, but you're not including, okay, this came from that source, so now you're plagiarizing.
Right. Correct. But if you give the credit, you can use the stuff all day as long as you're giving credit. It's showing that you're not trying to take ownership of the work. You're simply trying to use the work because it's going to prove some point, or it's going to illuminate on some point you were making by using that work.
Okay. Now you get into talking about the items pertaining to creating a business around the book. What are some of them items, Lewis?
Well, you're going to create a business around the book. One of the things I would do is you should have a website devoted to the book, meaning it's going to be a business. So whatever the nature, let's say it's some sort of self-help book, and maybe it's self-help having to do with home fixing up, right? Doing work around the home, like a carpenter. So you want to have a website with subject matter having to do with items that were covered in the book. You want to have a blog on that book where people can ask you questions relating to that subject, where you can then answer them, almost like you're running a business. You want to have a link. It would be good to have a LinkedIn page and start a group. I would start a group with the name of the book. This way, by starting a group, you're in charge of the articles that you post, and then other people can, you know, read your articles and interact with you. And if you join other groups, some other groups, you're going to see groups that have 5 people in them, but you're going to see certain groups that have 50,000 people in them. And if you put an article based off your book, or you're pushing your book in a group that has 50,000 people in it, that's a tremendous amount of exposure in a heartbeat, right? The second you do a post in LinkedIn that has a tremendous amount of people in a group, and people are reading that post, that useful post that you put in with useful information that people can use, at the end of your post, you might say, I run the group, such and such. I have a book. available, such and such. So you're helping to expose everything about you, about the book, and you're expanding your reach. So LinkedIn is a good way to expand your reach, get out there, because you're answering questions and you're lending knowledge that you have to other people's questions in other groups as well. So people are getting to see you and get exposure to you that might never had exposure to you if it wasn't for LinkedIn. So it's a great medium. Facebook page is good to have as part of trying to make a business out of it. You can use the Facebook page as a landing page so people can find you on Facebook. Maybe on Facebook you have links to your book and other offers. Maybe you do seminars as well. That's another way to monetize your book, is to take the information that you've put in the book and create a seminar out of it, whether you do that seminar live or you make that seminar an audio seminar or an audio-visual seminar where people can then buy a streaming download of something you've done. So you're creating, now you not only have a book, but you're putting yourself out there as a consultant concerning the items that you covered in the book, and you're creating a business out of it.
Okay, and that is a great way to get yourself noticed, is through Facebook. There's so many people who go to Facebook, and that's how I find different authors through that site. But Elman, I know that we're getting short on our time. I would love for people to know, how can they reach you if they have any further questions, if they want to find your book?
Okay. What I do, anybody can reach me by going to lowcostempire.com. I put my email on there and my phone number. Within every book I do, even in the books, I put my email and phone number. And I think I'm one of the few people who write books that welcome anybody who needs to call me after you've read a book. And you say, well, now what do I do?
That's good. That's how I did one author for one of my books for my professor class. I would actually contact him and ask him, what were you trying to say in this book? So I would be ready for class probably in another week, be like, oh, okay, he was saying this. I would actually contact the author myself.
That's good. And I encourage that, too. I have no problem doing that. And people who need any sort of consultation, I think I can give people a ton of info in 1 hour or less and not stretch it or make a big deal out of it. And I am very, very reasonable. And my whole thing is I want people to not be in a situation where they feel it's beyond them, where they feel that, this must be for other people with a lot of money. I guess I can't do these things. Or this dream of mine, I guess I'm going to have to let it go by the wayside. There's no way I can do it. It's very doable. Just take the time to read. Two books, tell you very quickly, two books that you should get if you're in the business of patenting is Patent It Yourself by David Pressman. You will literally get an education about everything to do with a patent for the layman. Perfect book for a layman. The other book I would get is License Your Invention, which opens you up to the world of licensing by Richard Stimm, STIM. Anybody in the retail or you have type of anybody with items that they sell, Retail MBA, retailmba.com. She teaches you everything about getting items into stores. And other people check out Amazon Local. It's free. Amazon Local, they use their mailing list locally for any item you sell. And the only pay when you sell, you pay them a very small commission. But they help set you up with a great, it's a campaign run. I don't know how long they are, 15 days or 10 days. And they blast it out to all their local customers on Amazon.
Okay.
And then people can pay for your service if they're a member of Amazon with the one-click feature. So there's some wonderful things out there that don't cost anything and give people a chance to compete.
Well, thank you, Mr. Elman, for this wonderful information. I hope that the listeners, they can get out there and take this experience and do what they need to do. And as he said, it doesn't take a whole lot. It just takes the effort to really push it forward. But, Elman, thank you again, and you have a blessed one.
You're very welcome. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Well,
listeners, as you heard Mr. Elman say, you can find his Kindle, Amazon, or Nook. It's been a pleasure, and tomorrow we'll have Toni Henderson on the show. She'll be talking about her book, Wise Courtship.
Thank you for tuning in to The Bright Side with Tanisha.
Come back daily from 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern.
God bless.